John Cohen, a correspondent for Science Magazine, so happy to have you back.
Thrilled to be back.
As you always are with us at these conferences. So what are your expectations from this one?
Well, I think that the world has come to a point now where it recognizes that all of the effort that has gone into making treatment available to people has overshadowed prevention. And this is the point in time where prevention is going to move into the spotlight.
In what ways?
Well, the world has made great progress on getting anti-HIV drugs to people who are in need of them and also to pregnant women who are infected. But it hasn't made great progress in preventing new infections. And I think there's going to be a lot of soul searching about what hasn't worked. In part, it's going to be about, here are things we know that work that aren't being applied. And in part, it's going to be, what should we be testing to see if these possibilities might work? But when you look around the world, there aren't a lot of places that can jump up and down and say, boy, have we really knocked the virus back in terms of new infection. And there are a lot of places that can jump up and down and say, we've really delivered a lot of treatment and a lot of prevention to pregnant women.
As I recall, in Toronto 2 years ago, there was some of the same kind of discussion, the tension between prevention and treatment. Is it going to be the same set of conversations we're going to hear, or has it moved forward?
I think it has moved forward, and I think it's probably the trickiest thing that people are going to have to wrestle with here, because a few years ago, the treatment rush had really just started. I mean, it was 2006, and remember, this whole drive to get treatment out really only starts 2002, 2003. So it was still early days in 2006. And now what we're seeing in 2008 is that the countries at the front of this, and I mean low and middle income countries, are saying, we can't sustain this. We have too many new infections. When you have 5 people becoming infected for every 2 people who go on treatment, how can you keep it up? The bank doesn't have that much money. And I think there's a stark realization from these countries at the front that they're in trouble.
Now, do you think we're going to be hearing this debate in the public at this conference, or are these the kinds of conversations that get played out behind closed doors between groups of people who only have this opportunity once every 2 years to be at the table together?
I think you're going to hear it loudly again and again and again from the leaders, because everyone realizes that this is not sustainable. And that as much progress as has been made, I mean, we've gone to 3 million people in low and middle income countries now receiving treatment. That's up from zero. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, you've got to celebrate that. And you've got to celebrate the number of babies who are being born with infected mothers who aren't infected. But, you know, put the cork back in the champagne. It's the new infection rate is so high in so many places that the ones that are paying attention are saying, whoa, mm-hmm. You know, yes, we've done a lot, but they are openly talking about it because they need new ideas, they want more funding, and they want to be able to address the things that they know work that they haven't been able to address.
Are we going to hear this week, is your expectation that there will be new ideas in science? Will there be any big announcements?
You know, this meeting has been bad-mouthed for so many years. It's been called a circus, and it's, you know, people just say all these really nasty things about me, scientists in particular, hardcore scientists. And I always learn something here that's cutting-edge science. I don't go in knowing what it's going to be because it's not obvious. The prevention stuff, that's obvious. It's going to be a big topic. The science stuff, I'm going to find the really new stuff in the posters. I'm going to find it when somebody goes to the microphone to challenge something that someone said. There's nothing in the program that makes me say right now, boy, that's a scientific session that's going to blow minds. But, you know, when we talk a week later, I bet you I have a laundry list of things that I didn't know that I think most of the scientific community will find interesting.
Well, I will come back at you with that question.
Great.
As we talk every day through the conference. I want now, though, to kind of turn the corner and talk about a remarkable series of articles that you've spent many months reporting, appeared in Science Magazine, and the main article was about following the money now going into HIV/AIDS. What were the big takeaway messages that you You got.
There's been a surge of funding that's occurred over the past decade. We've gone from about $450 million going to low and middle income countries to $10 billion. That's over a 20-fold increase. Astonishing amount mm-hmm. of money. What I wanted to look at was, number one, why did this occur? Why did people start reaching deeply into their pockets to help the low and middle income countries? And why did those countries themselves start ponying up? How has that money been used wisely? Where has it not been used wisely? Indeed, where has there been corruption? And what are the disparities? And one of the things I did was an analysis of the hardest hit countries in the world, 33 countries, and I asked how much money have they received from the four biggest donors, mm-hmm. and then how many HIV-infected people do they have in each country? And then looking at how many dollars they have received per HIV-infected person, and I found great disparities. This goes directly against the ethos of everyone everywhere deserves anti-HIV treatment regardless of their circumstances.
Well, you wrote in there, you what you said was this, it's created a new division of haves and have-nots within the developing world.
Yeah. That's what surprised me the most. You know, if you turn back the clock to 2000, to Durban, the international conference being held there in this mm-hmm. moment where the world realizes, hey, most of the HIV-infected people in the world don't have access to these great treatments that are working. We have to change the way we do business. And then you see that there's this shift that's remarkable toward, you know, helping these people. But it hits the wall. And it hits the wall because several countries around the world are really fragile. They have bad governments. They have civil wars. They have corruption.
And so the donors won't go in.
The donors don't want to go in. And in the case of the Global Fund, which is one of the biggest donors, it says to countries, you come to us and tell us what you need. They can't write a proposal that is that compelling because they don't have the civil society or they don't have the government and they don't have all the pieces that the Global Fund needs to say, yes, this can work. And remember, the Global Fund is performance-based. They give you a chunk of money. 2 years later, they look at you and they say, what'd you do with it? These countries, you know, Zimbabwe struggles with this. The Central African Republic struggles with this. The Democratic Republic of Congo struggles with it. These are all hard-hit countries that need help.
Now, in the article, you interviewed the man who created AIDSPAN, which is this independent watchdog group over the Global Fund. And what he talked to you about was a kind of mentoring program so that these countries that aren't getting any dollars can learn how to get them. Has that idea progressed at all?
Well, Bernard Rivers is his name, and he just floated the idea in April. Mm-hmm. So I think it's too new of an idea to know. He's a very provocative thinker, and he speaks to everyone on the ground. He really does a great job of that. I think that it's an idea that deserves serious consideration because these countries clearly need the help. And what he was suggesting is, okay, you can't go in and write the proposals for them, but you can help them see how to put the components together and, you know, actually write a good proposal, too. The writing matters, too.
You also quoted an economist who criticized the efforts of the big funders because they haven't taken the next step, he says, in figuring out how they all fit together.
It's a big problem. It's a problem of global architecture, is the language they use in global health. There is no architecture. There is no blueprint that says, okay, you take care of the right flank, I'll do the left.
So that one complements the other.
Exactly. The way they do it is they each have their own programs. They look over to the right and they look over to the left, but they don't sit down at the table and say, you know what, Democratic Republic of Congo, it's in trouble, what are we going to do? There's nobody sitting on top of the globe looking down and saying, with this stentorian voice, this is what we must do. There's no there. There's nobody running the show. Most of the gaps get filled in. I mean, you know, I think we have to be fair. It basically works. But when you see the number of countries that, you know, I think I found like 10% of the HIV-infected people in the world live in these countries that receive very little money, mm-hmm. very little assistance. Well, that's a lot of people. It's, you know, nearly 4 million people.
So after this very extensive reporting trip, it was several months, do you come away from it, John, feeling optimistic, pessimistic, depressed about when you go back out there a year from now, what you find?
I started covering HIV/AIDS seriously about 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. I have seen so much progress in ways that I never imagined that I largely end up feeling optimistic, in large part because it used to be I'd go visit a hard-hit country and just go to a hospital and see hundreds of people dying. That still exists, but I'm not seeing that as much. And I'm even going to countries like Botswana, where they have 87% of the people in need of treatment receiving treatment. You know, astonishing. In 2002, Botswana was the first country in sub-Saharan Africa to offer free treatment to everyone. Mm-hmm. So I'm really optimistic about that side of it. But I'm a journalist, and I'm a professional skeptic. And the pessimism is there, and it depresses me, too, when I see things that obviously could be done to help and aren't being done.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you so much.
John Cohen, correspondent for Science Magazine. I will talk to you again very soon.
Terrific, Jackie.
Okay.